the studios of 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Harlow Giles Unger is my guest. He has written many books, lots of them biographies of our founding fathers. His books are like time machines that transport you back to the 18th and early 19th century and bring to life the legendary figures of early America. His latest book is a biography of our sixth president, John Quincy Adams. Harlow Giles Unger, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
The cover of your book has this really wonderful portrait of John Quincy Adams by the great portrait artist of the day, John Singleton Copley, who, along with Gilbert Stuart, I guess, captured so many of the famous people of the era. When was this portrait made, do you know?
It was when John Quincy Adams was about 16. And was Secretary of the Legation
wow.
for the United States in St. Petersburg, Russia. At 16, he had already studied at the University of Leiden, spoke four European languages, modern European languages at the time, read and wrote and spoke classical Latin, classical Greek. He had studied the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, six-volume work by Edward Gibbon, an eight-volume history of England by Hume, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, a two-volume work, a classical work on economics. He was ready to go to Harvard a couple of years later and finish up at Harvard in a year and get his law degree in a year afterwards.
Just like any typical 16-year-old nowadays.
Yeah, at that time, he was only 16. At 16, I was reading Uncle Wiggily, but I went to Yale instead of Harvard. That's the difference.
That explains it.
But I read it in Latin. I read it in Latin, so.
Well, Adam's life was really... it really bridged the Revolutionary period and the Civil War period. I mean, he knew Washington and he knew Lincoln, and I guess he knew Napoleon too.
Yes, indeed. He lived a long life for that era. He lived 80 years, and 70 of those years spanned the most formative years of American history, from the eve of the Revolutionary War to the eve of the Civil War. And as you mentioned, he served under Washington and towards the end of his life served with Lincoln in the House of Representatives. In the interim, he knew and was friends with every major figure in Western European and American history. Jefferson, Franklin, Madison, Monroe. He knew the Duke of Wellington, Charles Dickens, the Tsar Alexander, Frederick the Great of Prussia. He knew them all, could talk to them all, spoke their languages. He was a diplomat, American ambassador to six European nations at the beginning of his public service career, and spoke six foreign languages so that he could converse. He was one of four American diplomats overseas, but the only one who could converse and understand so many languages, so many that he became unofficially the chief of our intelligence services, because he could go to these diplomatic soirees and understand everything people were saying.
How did people get around in those days? I mean, that's a stupid question, but you know what I mean. I mean, it's not like it is now, obviously. I mean, he traveled all over Europe and was how did communication work, and how did...
Well, it was very slow, mm-hmm. and you traveled by sailboat over the Atlantic. It was a very dangerous voyage, and when his father took him to Europe for the first time, he was only 11 years old. They were pursued by British gunships. They went through terrible storms. It was a really fearsome voyage, which I describe in my book, John Quincy Adams. It's really terrifying for a youngster at that time. But they did arrive in France safely, and At that time, they went to live in an apartment in Benjamin Franklin's palatial villa outside of Paris. They traveled in Europe on these coaches, which varied in size depending on how rich you were, and varied in the number of horses that pulled you. But travel was very, very slow and very dangerous.
Yeah, dangerous because of, well, in terms of traveling across the ocean, but dangerous traveling on the roads also?
Oh, absolutely. There were highwaymen at every turn of the road. You had to be, your driver, the coachman, had to be armed and be very, very wary of being robbed by coachmen. It was very, very dangerous. It was dangerous in this country as well. Travel was not for the weak. Or you had to be strong, resourceful to travel anywhere in the Western world at that time.
Well, Harlow Giles Unger, I know you're a horseman. What about John Quincy Adams? Was he a horseman as well?
Not really. From childhood, they lived on a small farm in his early childhood outside of Boston. They really didn't need... he did know how to ride. Everybody knew how to ride. But he wasn't the great horseman that George Washington or Thomas Jefferson was, because they lived on great plantations in the South where they had to travel hundreds of miles. John Quincy Adams really grew up in the outskirts of Boston and didn't need to become a horseman. He traveled usually by wagon, although he could ride a horse. And when he was only 7, 8 years old, he would ride in and out of Boston to bring news of the family in Boston to his mother, Abigail Adams, out on their farm. At the time, the British troops were occupying Boston, and it was the beginning. It was the eve of the American Revolution. When he was 7 years old, his mother heard cannon blasts in the distance and took her boy up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse. They could look across Boston Bay, and they witnessed the slaughter on Bunker Hill. They saw the troops run out of ammunition and ran back to the farmhouse, built a huge fire, and began melting down the Adams family's pewter flatware to make musket balls for the Patriot troops. And early on, John Quincy Adams is only 7 years old at the time, and his mother is already fighting for and having him help in the fight for the Patriots, for liberty. His mother told him at that time, he was only 7 years old, he told him that if you do not rise, and I'm quoting Abigail Adams now, if you do not rise to the head of your country, it will be owing to your own laziness, slovenliness, and obstinacy. I advise you to fix unalterable resolutions in favor of virtue and integrity and unchangeable love for your country. And that's how Abigail and John Adams raised their son, John Quincy Adams, from early childhood to be virtuous, to love and serve his country. And that's why it astounds me that Americans know so little about this giant of a man. He was a great, great American, and one of the great figures in early American history.
Aimed toward the presidency when he was 7, essentially.
Well, certainly leadership of his country.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, we love to rank our presidents, and I want to know where you would place the 6th president of the 43 men who've held the office. Where do you put John Quincy Adams?
Probably at the very bottom. His presidency, he accomplished nothing in his presidency. He was a one-term president because he refused to campaign. He believed it was beneath the dignity of a presidential candidate to campaign and make promises to the people that he knew he couldn't keep. fortunately, no candidate would do that today. They certainly must have learned from John Quincy Adams. So his presidency was forgettable. But as a man, he was one of the most important public servants in American history. The reason I wrote this book is that John F. Kennedy, himself a war hero, ranked John Quincy Adams first In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage, he ranked John Quincy Adams first as the most courageous figure in American history, the most courageous senator in American history, the most courageous congressman. And it's really, as his public service outside of his four-year presidency, for which John Quincy Adams is really a memorable figure. He, as I said, he was American ambassador to six European countries. He was chief U.S. negotiator at the peace conference that ended the War of 1812. He was Secretary of State for 8 years under President Monroe. He wrote the core provisions of Monroe's famous Monroe Doctrine, probably the greatest Secretary of State in American history. He was a congressman, he was a courageous senator. He was also a courageous congressman, a member of the House for 16 years, 8 terms, the first congressman to stand up in the House for emancipation before Lincoln even knew how to spell the word. He was a brilliant, brilliant lawyer involved in precedent-setting cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. He freed the 36 African prisoners on board the slave ship Amistad. Some of your listeners may have seen the film Amistad.
Can I just interrupt there?
Yeah.
Do you think that film was an accurate portrayal?
Oh, absolutely. A moving film.
Mm-hmm.
And Anthony Hopkins played John Quincy Adams pleading the case before the Supreme Court. I think the one area where the movie failed a little bit was to show the importance. Obviously, it was very important in the lives of those men and women who were freed. But it was far more important in the legal sense, in that John Quincy Adams's case that he pleaded, his argument, ended the legality of the slave trade. It was the first break in emancipation. He argued that these were not slaves on board that ship. These were freemen who had been kidnapped by slave traders, and that they had risen up and simply killed their kidnappers in self-defense. And the Supreme Court upheld that, and that changed the whole face of the slave trade. These were no longer slaves. Simply because your skin was black and you were an African, you were not a slave. You were a freeman. And it ended the legal slave trade between Africa and the United States. So this was an important legal decision that John Quincy Adams won before the Supreme Court.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I just want the people to know that we're chatting with Harlow Giles Unger, and his latest book is a biography of John Quincy Adams. Well, Adams's contemporaries, and especially the contemporaries of his father, John Adams, the second president, they were, some of them, like Jefferson, were slaveholders themselves. And they apparently didn't have a huge problem with slavery, or they wouldn't have allowed slavery to be a legal part of this country when they started it. So where did it happen that John Quincy Adams became opposed to slavery? Why was he opposed to slavery?
He was opposed to slavery early on. He called it the most evil taint on American society. Permit me to correct you a little bit.
Yeah.
All of the founding fathers were not like Jefferson. Jefferson was the epitome of the hypocrites among the founding fathers, saying all men are created equal except my slaves. He went home and to his slaves after helping to write that document. He did nothing during the Revolutionary War, but believed in liberty, but wouldn't fight for it. But people like Washington and Patrick Henry were against slavery from the very beginning. Remember, Americans didn't invent slavery. Europeans like to call this slavery an American institution. We inherited it. Slavery in this country, the first slaves in this country, came over in the early 18th century when we were a British colony. Slavery was a British, French, and Spanish institution, primarily to they took slaves to the Caribbean islands to cut sugar cane, to the Sugar Islands, as they were called then. And when they started importing slaves into the United States, the people of Virginia, the plantation owners of Virginia in the early 1700s, voted to ban slavery. And they appealed to Queen Anne, to good Queen Anne, as she was called, to stop the slave trade. She refused because England was making too much money trading slaves. So England refused to end the slave trade. By the time our founding fathers were born and merged into adulthood, the slaves in this country had grown, the number of slaves had grown from 15,000 at the beginning of the 18th century to 500,000. This was now third and fourth generation in the hundreds of thousands. What could they have done at that point? It was against the law by then to free your slaves. You were not allowed to do so. Patrick Henry fought for abolition all his life. Never bought. He owned slaves, but never bought or sold one. He owned the slaves because he bought properties, and the slaves were part of that property.
Was that true with Washington also? Because he had slaves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Washington freed his slaves in his will.
Hmm.
Washington said, long before he was president, he said, "There is no man who despises slavery more than I." And as I say, he wrote the first provision of his will was to free his slaves. And during his lifetime, the slaves he owned at Mount Vernon, that he and Martha owned, he trained them all, gave them all, taught them all trades and skills so that once they were free, they could earn a living. This was a great problem in the South. Where would they go, these 400,000 or 500,000 slaves? The South only had jobs for field hands. The South was not like the North, where you had cities and manufacturing plants, where there were jobs for skilled tradesmen. There were no such jobs in the South. There were no villages or towns. One plantation, the road out of one plantation went down and met, you got to the beginning of the road into the next plantation. The only opportunity in the South were for field hands. Here, George Washington said, there is not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of slavery in this country. An evil exists that requires a remedy. And he spent a good part of his life searching for that remedy.
And so you're saying that John Quincy Adams just took up that fight naturally?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. It was easy to free slaves in the North because there were jobs for skilled tradesmen. There were apprenticeships. There were ways you could learn a trade. There was no such thing in the South. So John Quincy Adams grew up hating slavery. His father and mother both hated slavery. His father, of course, was our first vice president and our second president, and one of the authors of the Declaration of Independence with Thomas Jefferson. But unlike Jefferson, he never owned a slave. He had a small farm outside of Boston, Massachusetts, in what is now Quincy, Massachusetts.
We're chatting with Harlow Giles Unger, and his books include Patrick Henry, Lion of Liberty, James Monroe, The Last Founding Father, and the award-winning Lafayette, and The Unexpected George Washington, His Private Life. His new book is called John Quincy Adams. You touch a little bit on in your book about John Quincy Adams' relationship with his wife. It seems a little strange. Tell us a little bit about it. He kind of mistreated her in one scene where he forcibly wipes her makeup off. And this is, you mentioned that this was a wound that his wife carried with her. What was this unusual? What kind of a guy was he, and how did he relate to women?
Well, he and Louisa fell in love early on, and they lived together for 6 years. They were, for the most part, they had a close, warm, loving relationship. It was when Louisa and he were in Berlin, and Louisa wanted to go to, and he were going to go to the Frederick the Great's ball, and she had been rather pale after a miscarriage, and the Empress had suggested that she wear rouge. Well, that was the big fashion in Europe, but it wasn't in Puritan America, where John Quincy Adams had come from. it was used by ladies of the night, not by respectable women. So he was astounded when she appeared ready to go to the ball with rouge on her face, and he took a cloth and wiped it off. And so upset her that she didn't go to the ball. So they had their fights, but most of their married life was really a very warm, loving relationship. But it was marred by more tragedy than the average family ever has to suffer. John Quincy Adams's mother, Abigail, who was born Abigail Smith, the Smiths carried the gene of alcoholism. Abigail's brother died of it. Two of her three sons, John Quincy's brothers, died of alcoholism. And two of John Quincy's and Louisa's three sons died of alcoholism. In addition, they lost two infants to childhood diseases, and Louisa had suffered a number of miscarriages. It was not that uncommon in those days, but it still was very, very wounding. And so they had their spats. Obviously, he had to be away from home a lot as a diplomat. They did have their spats, but at one point when he was away from her for a while in midwinter, he writes her a rather touching letter. He's in his room by himself, a very cold night in February, and writes to her, I may be able to live without you, but given the weather tonight, I'd much rather live with you.
Did you have access to all of his diaries? Apparently he kept volumes and volumes of diaries.
Yes, his father made him start writing a diary when he was 10 years old, and he became addicted to it. He was a great diarist and wrote a detailed diary every day for the rest of his life until just 3 weeks before he died. There are 14,000 pages in all.
Wow.
And it really is one of the great documents in American history because it details not only the life of how this man and his wife and his family lived, but it documents all of the events, the historic events of the day in which he participated. We get really an inside look into the history and the life and times of our nation during the first 80 years of its formation.
So, have you read it all?
Oh, absolutely, and studied it, excerpted it as much as possible. I let John Quincy Adams tell his own story in his biography.
Well, you've written about so many of our founding fathers. Do you feel like you know them?
Absolutely, they all knew each other, of course.
Yeah.
It was indeed a small world then, John Quincy Adams was Secretary of State for 8 years under James Monroe, and was he and Monroe, although they were from opposite political parties, they got along beautifully together. James Monroe had been James Madison's Secretary of State, and James Madison had been Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State, and Thomas Jefferson had been George Washington's Secretary of State. So they all knew each other. This was an era when the most educated, wealthiest, most educated men in the country ran the country, and they governed the nation, and the nation wanted it that way. They wanted the most educated, most successful people running the show. Joe the plumber did not try to lead the country in those days.
Well, what about, speaking of Joe the plumber, nowadays it doesn't matter who is elected president. Immediately, the opposing party is going to do their best to stifle their ability to be successful. In those days, was there a lot of opposition?
Absolutely. It was true in those days as well. Remember that at that time, the Constitution was a whole new concept. Our form of government had never been tried before in world history. So the Constitution, when it was passed, in 17 and went into effect in 1789 with the election of George Washington, he was elected as a Federalist, one who favored this central government. But the anti-Federalists, led by Patrick Henry, were opposed to central government. After all, they had fought a revolution for 8 years to throw off control by a central government in London. Now, here was this new central government, first in New York, then Philadelphia, and finally in Washington, controlling the nation and reproducing many of the conditions that we had lived under the British government. There was very little difference. The Constitution provided very few differences between this new government and the British government. We replaced the king with a president, and he had to be elected every 4 years, but he was elected really by an aristocracy. The only people who could vote under our Constitution at the time were white adult males who owned property. So that limited to really the equivalent of an aristocracy.
The people who were president were the only people who could vote for president.
Exactly. And the Congress could enact taxes without the consent of the people. Well, why did we start the revolution? Because we rejected the idea that Parliament could tax us without our being represented. Well, Congress could do the same thing. The states, state governments, and the people had no say in it. Congress could do whatever it wanted to. So there was precious little government. It was simply the American aristocracy now ruled their own country. They did not have to bow to the British king.
But they also didn't bow to the will of the people all that much.
Oh, no. The people had nothing to say. It was far more than 47% of the people who didn't vote. It was closer to 87% of the people who couldn't vote.
Including every woman.
No, women were chattel. Women had absolutely no civil rights. Children, of course, had none. And blacks, most blacks, were slaves.
What are you going to write next? What's your next book?
Well, the next book is about the presidency itself and how George Washington really usurped powers that were not given him under the Constitution and created what Schlesinger called the imperial presidency. The president now can take us to war whenever he wants to without the consent of Congress. He violates the Constitution every day of the week. Congress does the same thing. All three branches of our government now violate the Constitution at will. As former Vice President Cheney said a few years ago, in discussing the Constitution, he said it was a quaint document, which, of course, had to do with his his opinion of the Constitution. But Congress and the President and even the Supreme Court now ignore the Constitution. The Supreme Court legislates when it wants to. The president uses executive powers to enact laws without the consent of Congress and to take us to war whenever his advisors tell him to do so. We have troops all over the world now, not with congressional permission, but because the president wants them there. We have soldiers fighting in Honduras, in Central Africa, the so-called Republic of Central Africa. Forget about Afghanistan and places like that, but we're all over the world with so-called black operations that even Congress doesn't know about.
Well, that sounds like it's going to be some book. My guest is Harlow Giles Unger. He has my write-in vote for president, and his new book is called John Quincy Adams, and he's going to be back to talk to us about his next book when it comes out. Am I right?
Yes, indeed.
Well, Harlow Giles Unger, thank you so much for being my guest on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Harlow Giles Unger, his latest book, John Quincy Adams. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.